We're doing Maaseh Shimshon, and we'll pick up with the ninth section, where we started studying the ninth section. We'll analyze it again. Halo at achoteinu. So the Philistines are coming, and they're telling Samson's wife that she should reveal the secret, their interpretation of the riddle. Now, we have a rule in our class on the Jewish home. I often say, if you told your wife a secret, it's with the understanding she will reveal it. You told her, don't tell anyone. So check out Jewish history, check out common folklore. You'll see throughout there's this common theme where the wife is told, don't reveal the secret to anyone, and she does. So if all the cultures have this recurring theme, and in Tanakh we see this recurring theme, so then maybe us men have to wisen up a bit and realize that it's going to happen. And
nine orders of speech to women?
I'm not going into why. I'm just saying you see a consistent theme in all cultures. I don't know all cultures, but in many cultures, and in Jewish history, in Tanakh, so there is this tendency that a woman will often divulge a secret, even though she's been begged not to. Right. Your partners in life, we each have weaknesses, and you will ask her to maintain certain things in confidence, and you will do that knowing that there is a high probability that eventually that confidence will be broken. And you won't hold it against her and tell her, well, how could I ever tell you a secret again? And you won't go off the handle, because you'll realize, yes, this is part of the nature of marriage, part of the nature of the relationship, part of the nature of things that are shared in confidence. Ein ma la'asot. It definitely gives room for thought about which things to share. In marriage, you do share almost everything. But sometimes, if there's something that's really critical to be kept private, so then you have to think about it. Because you have to realize that once you share it, it's going to be passed on. It might not be passed on within a day, maybe not within a week. But over time, that's what happens. We mentioned, and we'll mention again, the story of Rabbi Meir and Bruria. Right? You guys remember? Rabbi Meir told Bruria that women's strength is not in the realm of da'as. Men have their principle, they're very strong in da'as. Women have bina, they have understanding, they have other strengths. We diverge, and that's why very often women will say, I know you have your principles, but we can't hurt this friend, we can't hurt this relative, we have to find ways of making peace. And the man will say, nope, I'm not giving in, I'm not doing that, I'm not going to their simcha, I'm not going to invite them to my simcha. He's got all kinds of principles. So each one has their strength. But the idea that women can be convinced that their da'at is more easygoing, da'atan kala, is often viewed as a weakness. We have to understand it's a strength. It means that a woman is going to be softer with the children. It means that in the to and fro of maintaining the peace in the house, she's going to have that strength to be flexible to maintain the peace in the house. It shouldn't be looked down upon. We're different. They have their strengths, we have our strengths. There is an area where that tendency of being a da'atan kala can be to a woman's detriment, just like there are areas where men's tendency to have da'atam kveda, to have a heavy da'at, can also be to their detriment. And that's the story of Rabbi Meir and Bruria, where Rabbi Meir said to Bruria that as wise as she is, she could be seduced, and Bruria insisted she could not. And unfortunately, he proved her wrong, and she committed suicide. So as wise as she was, Rabbi Meir was able to get someone to seduce her, although she didn't sin, but she realized she was fully capable of it, that Rabbi Meir won the argument, but he won and he lost. He lost his wife. The phenomenal, the amazing Bruria. So we're going into all this because it gives us a perspective on what's about to happen. The Philistines know they can tap into Shimshon's wife if they speak correctly. It's the same idea as the serpent turning to Eve. If we can only show that we're connected, if we can enter conversation, then we can seduce a person or misguide a person. It's just a question of knowing how to speak. And that's why it's so important that prayer we say every morning, Shetatzileni me'adam ra. God, save me from the encounter of an evil person. Because when you encounter such a person, you never know where you'll end up. You never know what their agenda is. And so the Philistines begin by showing Shimshon's wife how close we are. Halo at achoteinu. Aren't you our sister? Sister. And we discussed where this term achoteinu actually appears in Tanakh with regards to Dina, etc. There are two major approaches when you try to win someone over. You can win someone over by showing them how weak you are, how much you need them. You call up, you want them to change your seat on the flight. So you can call up and say, you know, I really feel nauseous on flights, and I know that you don't really have to change the seat on my behalf, but you know, I really suffer when I'm sitting in a middle seat, and I know that it's tight and all the seats are taken, but maybe there's a way you can do it because you know how much I'd suffer on a 12-hour flight. So you make yourself one down and you ask the other side to help. Then sometimes you can try to show that we're the same. You know, I'm sure that your job is really tough. I once worked as a flight attendant. I once worked as a receptionist. You try to show how we're on the same plane. We're on the same. We're equals. We share things. And through that, you try to convince someone. Now, the Philistines come to Samson's wife and they say, "Sister, aren't you our sister? Mishalshenu apogem ben timnata. You're from the same blossoming root from the sons of Timnat. We don't believe that you'll turn us back empty-handed." And that's another method of manipulation. You give the other person a feeling that they can't let you down. It's very dangerous, but it is manipulation. You have to know that it's a good tool. Sometimes it could be used really well. In education, for example, if you want a child to be positive, you can sometimes speak in a way that assumes he's positive. I can tell you, I've been doing this for almost 2 decades now, where I'll give children in shul an amount of money. So in the United States, I'd give them a quarter or 2 quarters. Here in Israel, I give them 30 agurot, and I walk away. I don't look at what the kid's doing with the money. The kid knows I'm expecting him to put it in charity, but I don't look over his shoulder. Now, there's an unspoken trust that he's going to live up to. I don't think any kid ever pocketed the money. As far as they know, I'm not following them, but I am. And I turn around and I walk away, but I am waiting to hear that jingling. You know, so there's a tool. When you speak to someone, if you give them the feeling, you know, I'm confident that things won't go wrong here, you're building the person. And it's a way of educating. It's a way of helping a person grow. It can also be a way of manipulating someone. So they're coming to Shimshon's wife, and they're coming with an illegitimate claim, and they say, "We don't believe that you'll turn us astray. We don't believe you'll let us go back empty-handed. Et panenu ke'et asher atanu chalot panayich. We've come to beg you." Again, they're trying that angle. Notice they tried all three angles in one sentence. "Sister, we need you." Right? Im tovi lishma lefatot et ishech ve'yaged lanu dvrechi dato. If you agree to accept what we've said, to seduce your husband, he'll tell us his riddle. Ki im tacharishi, because if you will be silent, and here we went into where this pasuk appears, you remember? Ki macharish tacharishi, and the juxtaposition between her and Esther, the exact opposites. Evrot apenu alach nafitza, and now they're taking the one-up position. If you don't, I'm going to talk to your manager. If you don't upgrade me, I'm going to talk to them because I'm a steady client with this airline and I'm not going to have it that you didn't upgrade me or you didn't switch my seat. So you can approach something from one angle, another angle, and now the third angle. And they tell her, if you don't, you will bear our wrath. And there's a fourth angle, and that is threatening the family members. And that's what they're doing here to Shimshon's wife. They tell her, we're going to burn you and your father's house. Do you think it's beyond our capacity to do that? And now they turn it around, and they become the victim. And that's another method that people use when they're manipulating or when they're abusing. They make the other person feel like they're the ones being abused. They're the ones who were wronged. This is very scary as you follow the sentences here. They're telling her to betray her husband. They're telling her to help them in something that they have no right to do, to endanger her own marriage. And now they turn the tables on her, the way an abuser often does, and they say, hey, you're coming to make us lose all our money? Is that what you brought us here for? So now that's a fifth method of putting pressure. Notice how Ramchal each time gave one sentence, but each sentence really encompasses a whole personality type. And these are things we encounter in life. I find that if you define these five attitudes, you can zone in when people are using them on you. It's a very useful tool. If you can, sometimes by recognizing that these are the methods people will use, you can suddenly realize, hey, that's what they're trying to do to me. And then you could say, wait a second, that's not right. I didn't wrong you. I didn't do anything wrong. If your soul and the soul of your family is precious in your eyes, hayi le'eshet chayil, be a woman of valor. Oh. It sounds humorous, but I think this is where we left off, that there's a constant urge within a woman to live up to that woman of valor, to live up to that. And most women will testify that they spend life with a certain element of frustration, feeling that they're not living up to it. The average woman will tell you that she looks back at herself and says, why don't I do as much as this neighbor, that neighbor, this woman I read about, this woman I learned about? And we mentioned, I think, last week that many women say that when you read the Ishas Chayil Friday night, they feel like it's a guilt trip. It's like a... What's he saying there? Umei ishech et chidato tzi, achal tagidi lanu. You get the riddle from your husband, and then you'll tell us, penagalach me'od ufenachida et betech mitochenu, lest we harm you greatly and make your house scarce from our midst.
So basically, everything up to now is just trying to make the choices, either your family back in Philistine or your husband. If you just come out and say at the beginning that's your choice, maybe she doesn't feel there's a chance she'll turn it down. But when you say all these other things, it's just setting her up so that the chances become much less. You're going to die, your family's going to die, right? So it's all, like you say, a big psychological ploy. But this is where it gets interesting. A person doesn't have the right to condemn someone else to death to save themselves in the third person in this way, right? Certainly not your husband, only anybody.
So there's a big question, because the way Ramchal sets it up, she doesn't seem so bad. The ones who are so bad are the Philistines, not her.
Well, if she was so bad, they wouldn't have to go through this whole ruse to try and change up. They just say, listen, you're one of our people.
But from the Tanakh, that's what it seems. And the Tanakh only says, they told her, you know, have you come to inherit us? We're going to burn your house down. It sounds like an exaggeration.
Shimshon seemed like a nincompoop, you know, it's misrepresented, like Yitzhak, you know, not being able to tell. You know, it's the same thing. We know after, you know, between the lines that he didn't marry this woman, this leader of Israel, this judge, because he was an idiot. she felt that she was sincere, I assume, at the time. And you know,
yeah, that's what the Rambam writes. Okay, that's a very good point. So Ramchal is really making Shimshon's wife to be a victim. Everyone else is coming here and threatening her, and she's stuck. She's stuck in a very big quandary. According to the way Ramchal's playing it out, it seems her major mistake was not sharing it with Shimshon, and even that cannot really be blamed, because how could she know what would happen? You know, it's like when the kidnapper says, if you tell the cops, so, you know, you're endangering the kidnapped person's life. So, what are you supposed to do? You say, yeah, go tell the cops, but you never know.
It's a huge test we should never have, but you're not allowed, right, to condemn someone to death to save another. Especially, I mean, your husband, you can't even do it with this. Really, with a stranger.
But who is she?
She knows that by she's going to write Shimshon's death warrant.
Why? If she gives, they're telling her, if you don't reveal, we'll kill your father's house. They're not saying they'll kill Shimshon.
Okay.
So, technically, for a little bit of money, she's right in saving her family.
Yeah, except for the fact that she's got to know. They just don't want to know his weakness for curiosity's sake. You know, there's a reason they want to know his.
But this isn't Delilah. This is Timnit. This isn't about his weakness. This is about
right. This is his wife, and technically, the way Ramchal is setting it up so far, he's making her out to be pious. You know, if a woman has a choice, her husband should lose 30 suits, or her father's house should be burnt down with him in it. So she made the right choice. Right. You know, Ramchal turned the table on us here. Suddenly, the Philistine woman ain't so bad. Okay, let's see how the story continues. Ania sezot, ime tzokach. Yes?
They come there in the wedding because of her, or they want to come there.
So of course they had a choice. And of course they had a choice whether to enter the riddle or not. Obviously they have no right to do what they're doing.
They come there, I don't know why they come there.
Right. Of course they, the Philistines, are in the wrong. The question is, now that I know they're in the wrong, how wrong was she for giving in to them? That Ramchal is making it seem like she wasn't so bad. As a matter of fact, I'd say she was right. Okay, let's open to Chronicles, Divrei Hayamim, Days, the second chapter. So Yochanan, what we do here is we start looking up the different words and quotes to see where they show up in Tanakh. And we see, we've been finding, that very often Ramchal quotes words or sets of words that show up only once in Tanakh.
Okay.
So then you look it up and say, wait, what's he alluding to? Why did he choose these words here? So let's take the words in the Timnius's answer. What does she answer them? Ani esezot, I will do that, im e'etzol koach, if I will manage to girdle my strength. So if we open to our Tanakh to Divrei Hayamim Beis, Chronicles B, the second chapter, we will see where this term shows up. Divrei Hayamim Bet Bet. You have here, Tanakh, if you'd like. Divrei Hayamim Chronicles B, the second chapter. So let's see what the second chapter tells us. We'll start with the second verse, because that's, according to Jewish tradition, that's really where the story begins. King Solomon sent to Huram, the king of Tzor, sometimes translated as Tyre, saying the following, just as you did with my father, King David, you sent him cedar trees, because Tzor is in the north, that's near Lebanon, where they have fantastic cedar trees. So you sent my father these cedar trees to build a house for him to live in. Hinan even a bait l'shem Hashem Elokai. I am building a house in the name of Hashem, my God. Lakdish lo lakdir lefanav k'tor tzamim, to dedicate to God, to offer incense before him. Umarechet tamid, and a system. We will have the sacrifices continuously. V'olot laboker v'la'erev l'shabbatot l'chadashim. Sacrifices every morning, every night, every Sabbath, every first of the month, the holidays. And I will build this house magnificently, ki gadol lokenu mikol elokim, because our God is greater than all forces. Umi ya'atso koach livnot lo bayit. Who can girdle the strength to build a home for God? The heavens and the heavens above can't sustain God. Who am I to build a house for him? All I can do is offer before him. So I'm building this house. So we've seen throughout the play that Ramchal chooses sets of words either from marital relations throughout Tanakh or words that refer to the temple. And we said that perhaps Ramchal is repeatedly alluding to this idea that the house is a miniature temple. The relationship between man and woman should be one of sanctity. In Samson, we see a man who seemingly is very attracted to the physical aspect of marriage, or at least on some level, he is attracted to that. And Ramchal repeatedly throws in words that refer us back to the temple, to the house that should be. So the verse over here says, who can girdle their strength to build a house for God? Now let's go to our play. What does Delilah say? I will do this if I will be able to girdle my strength. And perhaps Ramchal is alluding to this idea that just as building a temple is something that is really magnificent and requires girdling your strength, it requires really harnessing your strength to build it, so too the house requires harnessing strength. It's not easy. It doesn't go on autopilot. And what she's saying is, I will harness my strength if I can do this. We can understand this in two veins. Either, you know, she's destroying her house with this. We know this was the end of their marriage. But the flip side is, if we're going in line with how Ramchal has been painting her as, he's portraying her as someone who's really stuck in a bind, so then maybe Ramchal is alluding to the idea that she is harnessing her strength to protect her father's house. Not such a bad move. Here we have to take a step back and open a can of worms, which I don't want to go into, but it is food for thought. Whenever a person converts or is chozel b'tshuva, there is this challenge. What relationship should they have with the home they came from? You cannot ignore the fact that they brought you up, they brought you thus far, and there's a certain element of appreciation you owe them. On the other hand, you cannot ignore the fact that you're trying to build forward. And there will come a time, and that time might have come, where the relationship with them has to shift. Because if it remains the way it was, then you can't move forward. Just as when a person marries, there's an element of severance. You sever a certain amount of the ties you had to your parents. Otherwise, you can't build a marriage. You can't be mama's boy. If you're still mama's boy, then you ain't going to be your wife's boy. It's not going to work. You want to get married, you have to be able to walk away from the house and build your own home. By the same token, a person enters observance, so there's an element where you're marrying a new way of life. Not so simple to maintain the relationship the way it was. This is a challenge every person, or most people, face when they start observing Torah and mitzvot, and it's a challenge which requires a lot of thought. It's worthwhile talking to other people. It's worthwhile talking to teachers who have experience. Here in Samson's wife, we see the ultimate challenge. What do I do now? They're going to kill her father if she's faithful to Samson. We can't blame her for turning on Samson. It's not so severe, you know. What'd she do? She made him lose 30 suits. The Philistines tell her, Asota si gam yachol tuchali. You will be successful. That term, yachol tuchal, you will be successful, appears once in Tanakh. We're about to learn it in our Tanakh classes. Let's open up to the book of Samuel. Samuel A, the 26th chapter. Shmuel Aleph Chaf Vav. Isn't it interesting how Ramchal repeatedly chooses words that appear only once? It strikes me because it takes a special genius to be able to find those words. Every time he takes a pair that doesn't appear more than once, and then you're pretty much cornered. Now you got to look at it and see, what's he saying?
Does he know all of this by heart?
It certainly seems that way. I'm saying it seems he not only knew it by heart, but he also knew if it happened once, we'd say fine. But we've already pointed out at least 50, if not 60, maybe closer to 100 times that he chose words that appear only once in Tanakh.
Maybe he has a sermon with places that
appear just once. And we've been going all through Tanakh, back and forth. You know, I have it easy. I'm working with the computer. But he was working with his mind. So this is a story we're going to learn about in a week or two, where King David has his own men turn on him. The tribe of Judah turns on him. He's in a desert called the Desert of Ziph. And the people of Ziph come to King Saul and tell him, "We know where David is." And Saul tells them, "Well, I'm not coming right now. I want you to research every hiding place he has. Come back to me with organized maps. And when we know exactly where he runs and where he hides and where he stays, then I'm coming, because then we'll for sure capture him." David is confident. He's in Judean territory. It's his relatives. And he lets his guard down to a degree. The people of Ziph come back to Shaul and they say, "We have it all mapped out." And they give him all the directions and they come with him. And he takes 3,000 chosen soldiers, and he's coming to chase David. And after the first time that this happened, where King Saul came and at the desert of Ziph, he almost caught David. David was running, and everywhere he went, suddenly he saw Saul's men, and he couldn't think, and he ran up a mountain, figuring he'd come down the other side, and Saul didn't follow him. He sent his men to surround the mountain, and David was caught. And a miracle happened. In the last minute, King Saul got word that the Philistines are attacking him from the other side, and if he doesn't go right now, he's losing the country. And he had no choice. He had to leave, even though he had David cornered. So this time, David doesn't run. He doesn't about face. This is the second time King Saul has come after him to this desert. And this time, David sends spies. They check out where Saul is camping. And that night, when Shaul goes to sleep, David approaches Saul's camp. Saul is lying in the center, and everyone is camped around him. And David asks his men, "Who's coming with me into the camp?" And Avishai, who is his nephew, the son of his sister Tsruya, says, "I'm coming with you." So they come, and everyone is sleeping soundly. And Avishai tells him, "God's given you your enemy. I'll take my spear with one shot. I won't have to hit him twice. It's over." And David says, "God forbid. He's the anointed one of Hashem. God anointed him." King David says, "I swear by Hashem, either God will kill him, or his day will come, or he'll die at war. But God forbid, I won't touch the one anointed by God. Rather, take the spear that's near his head, take the flask of water." Then David has second thoughts. "No, don't go near him. I'll go." He's scared that Avishai might not live up to David's orders. He goes in, takes the flask, takes the spear, and goes out. God has caused the whole camp to have a deep slumber. David crosses to the next hilltop, and he calls out. And he says, "Avner, Avner, why don't you answer, Avner?" And Avner says, "Who's calling the king's men?" David says, "Avner, you're such an important person. How is it that you didn't watch the king properly? You know, someone was about to kill the king a minute ago. This isn't right. You all deserve death. How come you're not watching the king properly? Your master is anointed by God. Tell me, where's the king's flask of water? Where's the king's spear? It was right near his head." And Shaul wakes up. And he hears David's voice. And he says, is that your voice, my son David?" Remember, David's a son-in-law. David says, "It is my voice, my master, the king. Why is it that my master is chasing after his servant? What have I done? What's wrong? Listen here, my master, the king. Listen to the words of your servant. If God has caused you to be incensed against me, let this be an offering before him. And if people have incensed you, so then they are cursed before Hashem, because things have gotten so bad that I haven't been able to approach the temple. I've had to leave the land of Israel. I've had to live among pagans. It's as if they told me, go worship other gods. Who are you chasing? You're chasing a little speck, a little flea. Why are you chasing? And Saul says, and let's see, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Vayomer Shaul Chatati. Saul says, I've sinned. Shuv Beni David, return my son David, Ki lo ara lecha od, I won't harm you anymore. Tachat asher yaka nafshi beinecha hayom hazeh, being that my soul was so precious in your eyes this day, hinei hiskalti v'eshger b'meod, I've been foolish, I've erred greatly. Vayan David, and David says, let someone pass over and take the king's spear, and God should repay a person for his righteousness and his faithfulness, because today you were in my hands, and I didn't want to extend my hand against the one anointed by God. And just as your soul was precious in my eyes today, so too may my soul be precious in the eyes of God, and may he save me from all harm. The final word, Vayomer Shaul el David. King Saul is now cornered. He has to face up to the fact that David is righteous and pious and could have killed him and did not. Baruch ata bni David, blessed are you, my son David. You will perform, v'gam yachol tuchal, and you will succeed. V'gam yachol tuchal, you will succeed. Succeed, in essence, in being king instead of me, in usurping me, in leading the people of Israel, you will have the scepter. Now let's go back. So the one place in Tanakh where we see these two, Asota se en yachol tuchal, is where Saul concedes, David, you will succeed. And we've seen repeatedly where Ramchal borrows from these terms about David for this play, and the Philistines tell her, Asota si gam yachol tuchali, you will do, you will succeed. What's the connection? You will do, you will succeed.
It's just a fool. They call like that, but it's a wicked one. It's not real. They promise like to live. You will be like God. Exactly the ugly liar or something like that.
Yeah.
If you work for me, I will give you 10,000 shekels. But it's not true.
So I'm not sure what Ramchal is alluding to here. I'm not sure why he chose that, but I think that it's in the vein of what you're saying, that he's alluding to the idea that they're promising her like everything's going to be good if you do this, and that's part of the vile venom of an abuser, where the abuser is always promising, you do it my way, you'll see things will be good for you. It's the mafia, it's the abuser, it's a constant theme when you're trying to force your hand to manipulate someone else. So I also thought that that might be why he chose these terms, but I'm not sure. Not sure. So,
do the Plishtim want her to help lead them?
Help?
Like, lead them.
What do you mean?
Like, maybe the Plishtim see her as the bridge of, like, being able to join, like, Israel and Plishtim together. And that Shimshon could become, like, the ruler, and she's their, like, director.
So you're taking me to a point which I keep thinking about. What's the riddle they're trying to figure out? This goes back to what Aviel was saying earlier. Shimshon's riddle was, look at how a Philistine could come out of the Philistines, and from being the consumer, it can be something that's sweet, right? What are they telling her? You're one of us. You're not one of them. So it's the exact opposite. If they only would have thought about what they should have thought, you know, she's now one of theirs. She's now Shimshon's wife. Then they would have seen so clearly that that's exactly the riddle. And perhaps that's what Ramchal is trying to point out to us, that they didn't see that because they weren't prepared to see that. And that's a weakness that many people have, where someone has made a move in their life and they refuse to see that that person made that move. It could be a person matures, and there was a mother, her little boy was sitting at the table. The kid's already 14 or 15, and someone he passes the juice, and she goes over to pour it for the kid. So you stand there and you ask yourself, a 14-year-old can't pour his own cup of juice? But no, in his mother's eye, he's still her baby. She's not willing to accept that this isn't the baby anymore. So the Philistines are not willing to accept that min ha'ochel yatzah ma'achal, that she's no longer the consumer. She's no longer one of them who's supposed to devour Shimshon. And the question is, what point is Ramchal trying to push? Is it the Philistine perspective? Is it her perspective? Is it the perspective we should have and Shimshon should have had, that she'll never be faithful to him? I'm not sure which point Ramchal is trying
to
make here.
Maybe he's weighing them all up.
Yeah, it's a good playwright. That's why it's not just in your face all this way. It gets you see subtle.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Tom?